Hello everyone and welcome to the first episode of the Cultural Intelligence Podcast series by RWS. Today we're welcoming Marina Pancheva to talk all things about when AI goes global, culture, trust and the limit of scale. We are going to cover three main points today. The first one is why culture is one of the hardest variables for AI to model. And also the easiest for leaders to underestimate. We're going to talk about the risks connected to monocultural AI, and we're also going to talk about what leaders need to take into consideration for AI to work reliably in the real world. Stick around till the end to have Marina's secret recipe for enterprise AI to remain culturally impactful in the real world. Hello everyone and welcome to our Cultural Intelligence podcast series by RWS. Today we're going to talk all things about when AI goes global, culture, trust and maybe a bit the limits as well of scaling it. We are welcoming, warmly welcoming Marina Pancheva, Director of Linguistic AI Services at RWS. Marina, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me here. I'm very happy to meet you. Yeah. And it's amazing to have two Marinas on a podcast, isn't it?
I'm sure everyone is going to be very happy to hear that we're interviewing you. You're just very active in the field, like you're presenting everywhere. So yeah, it's an honor to have you here today, really. Do you want to maybe start by introducing yourself shortly before we dive right in?
So my name is Marina Pancheva. I'm Director of Linguistic AI Services at RWS. And I started as a theoretical linguist, so I have an academic background and a love for research, which I still keep in me. But I joined this industry, localization and translation industry, about 10, 12 years ago. I think it's more like 10. And yeah, I've been through it all. I first started as regular analog linguistic services, and then had a couple of very exciting projects where I got to work a lot on quality, working with translation community, until I reached the stage when AI became a thing. So I started exploring AI, and gradually we formed the Center of Excellence on AI Research and Development, which then branched off into delivery, service delivery, and there is still the branch of research and development. So our daily work is focused on finding ways to implement AI in linguistic services in a way that makes really sense, meaning implement AI where it really helps, brings value, and also be aware of the limitations that AI has, in a way counteracting the hype a bit, knowing, you know, where we can use it, where we can't use it, and researching all the time as the field is moving at an immense speed.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, what a time to be alive when this is your topic of expertise, you know, like with all the developments and
it's fascinating.
It's moving
so fast.
I can imagine, yeah. We even feel it obviously outside of, you know, the expertise kind of field, and I can't imagine how much there is to understand and yeah.
So yeah, it's an ever-expanding kind of border of knowledge. So, you know, the feeling, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. And it's moving so fast that I'm constantly having the feeling that I am catching up, and I'll never catch up with the knowledge that is out
there.
Yeah,
I can imagine that. All right, let's dive in. How do you think leaders should define culture in the context, of enterprise AI and global content?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, defining culture, my first instinct is let's define culture in the first place, right? So there are different ways to define culture. There is the kind of psychological take on what culture is, which means like a individual person's behavioral habit, the way they react in different situations. But I think the one which is more relevant for us is the anthropological definition of culture as being a system of shared values, reaction styles, you know, behaviors in different contexts. And that's very important because these shared values create predictability. And the predictability creates trust. So this is a very simple explanation for a five-year-old why two people from the same culture, they feel that they can have friendship easier, right? Because by us sharing the same culture, I actually can predict how you're going to react to what I do. And by me knowing how you're going to react, I can trust you. I feel safer. If I meet a person from a totally alien culture, I may say something, mean something, but it gets interpreted in a different way. The unpredictability factor rises, and thereby also the insecurity and the instinct for self-preservation and all those things, you know, that mark our behavior, you know, at the very basic level. So shared culture creates predictability, which in turn creates trust. And this is what global leaders should actually be aware of, right? It's the trust element of the end customer that matters here. But thinking about enterprises, I think, again, we have two levels of culture. One is the kind of the company culture or the brand culture. It's like the message you want to send to the world about your culture, your product, what you deliver. As an example, like let's take a famous shoe producer, right? Their culture and message and brand is about individual achievement. Just do it, right? It's very individualistic. So it would speak very easily to end user from a Western type of culture, which is more individualistic, right? And this message is the core message. It's the kind of makes the core of the culture of the brand. And it has to be preserved. Like you cannot change that for different markets. You cannot transform just do it to let us all do it, right? It breaks the message and the culture. So that core culture must be preserved. But then it has to be fine-tuned for the regional culture of the markets, right? So while you're keeping your core message, you may have to deliver it differently for the American market and for the Japanese market. So while it is just do it, and it is placing focus on individual achievements, the way you talk about it may have to be changed when this is marketed in a more collectivist culture where the values are different and it's more like the group achievement than the individual achievement of a single person. So for global leaders, what is very important is to, on the one hand, preserve their core culture that characterizes the brand, and on the other hand, fine-tune it and modify it for the regional variations, but still preserving that core message without losing it. I always think about it, you know, I always try to explain things to my kids. So I always think about it like, think Coca-Cola. It has a taste, and it is a unique taste, right? Everybody recognizes Coca-Cola, but in fact, it tastes slightly differently in every market. It is sweeter in Asia. It is a bit sharper in Europe. So just do it the Coca-Cola style. Your culture, brand culture is, you know, the beverage. And then you change it slightly for the different markets to fine-tune it to the specific taste of the end user. Mm-hmm. Also the cultural taste.
Mm-hmm. I always ask myself this question about culture. Where does it really end? Because a family in itself is a culture, you know? So, yeah, you have the country, the culture of the country, but how far can you take it? You know, it's kind of never ending, really. Obviously, you have general standards that apply for groups of people in general, but can you really? It's like nearly persona per or person per person at this point, you know?
Well, that is a bit the transition from the psychological definition of culture, which starts with the individual, to the anthropological definition of culture, which basically applies to a whole ethnic group. Mm-hmm. But you're totally right. Culture is not a discrete thing. It's not that if we have a border between two countries, suddenly,
yeah,
you know,
exactly,
you have completely different behavior.
Yeah,
it,
yeah.
Flows.
Yeah,
it flows.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is constantly the interaction between different cultures, which generate new cultures and so on. That's the fascinating thing. But you'd be surprised how many universal things there are about culture. Like there are cultural universals and universal human values that are shared across cultures. Just like even you know, body language, facial expressions. Facial expressions differ in different cultures, right? The way people smile, nodding, you're nodding at me, right? If you were in Bulgaria, that would mean no all the time because it's reversed, right? In Bulgaria, nodding is negative and shaking your head is positive, right? Super confusing. But there are, so that's definitely not universal. Yeah. But smiling is universal everywhere. Now, it depends on how much you smile. In some cultures, it's not appropriate to show one's teeth. So you smile without showing your teeth. In other cultures, you can laugh out loud and it's totally appropriate. Sadness, crying, these are universal kind of messages that you can send. And it's the same with culture. If we have time, we can dig into cultural universals, which have been established through a fascinating social and cultural experiment called Moral Machine, where which basically asks people from all over the planet. There were like 233 countries that were surveyed and more than 40 million answers to the survey about moral decisions which reflect moral values and cultures. And there were a couple of universals that applied to all decisions that people make. Yeah. We can get into that if there is time.
I might have a little question that I think will lead you to talk again about this later.
Looking forward.
How do cultural bias creep into AI models and workflows, and why does it happen? Where does it happen?
Unfortunately, there are many doors and even portals through which cultural bias creeps into AI models. The one that is biggest, probably, is through data, training data. So unbalanced data sets where one culture is overrepresented are going to lead to AI models adopting this culture, absorbing it from the training and becoming basically a monocultural AI. Even though this model might be multilingual, it will still be a monocultural AI model. And in reality, that's what's happening because between 70 and 95% of training data for the really large models, you know, the ones coming out of Silicon Valley and other big models, is actually English data. And the rest is primarily data coming from the Western digitalized world, right? That would be Spanish and German and so on. Minority languages, long-tail languages are underrepresented. So by necessity, AI models actually learn about Western culture and they absorb the Western cultural values, like the so-called weird culture. I'm not a big fan of this acronym, but it's like Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic society. So data is one of the portals through which bias creeps into, and cultural bias creeps into AI models. But then there are also other ways. One is another source for bias and cultural bias comes from the humans themselves, human labeling, for example. So in the process of training a large language model, there are different stages. In the first stage, it is called pre-training. So you use massive amounts of data. And this data, as we already mentioned, is unbalanced data, predominantly English, right? But then in the next stages, you actually use humans to fine-tune the model and teach the model to be a helpful assistant and respond adequately to questions and so on. And there is one stage called reinforcement learning through human feedback, where humans, you know, need to provide feedback which responses from the AI are best, like with to teach the model produce the kind of completions that humans like best. And that's where a lot of cultural bias comes in. Because you as a human, if you are given three versions of a prompt completion and you are asked to choose the one that you like best to rank them, you're going to rank the one that is aligned to your culture, your beliefs, your values as the best one because it aligns with you. This comes from the so-called confirmation bias that humans have. We like and we choose and we think that those answers, completions, you know, facts that align with our own beliefs and understandings and values are correct. Unfortunately, this bias, this cognitive bias, is so strong that not even intelligence can beat it. In fact, there is a very disturbing piece of research which shows that the more intelligent a person is, the more they are susceptible to confirmation bias. Yes, this is bad news. I agree. Yes. Very bad news. But there is a logical explanation to that. The more intelligent a person is, the more they can interpret evidence in a way that it would in the end confirm their preconception, right? Yeah. So another source of bias comes from labeling. Like sometimes we just need to have a label data. For example, sentiment labeling, like label these images. Is the person here happy or unhappy? Or label this message. Is it polite or impolite? Now, a very direct message, say a response to a user flagging an issue, right? If it needs to be labeled, a German labeler will say it's perfect, it's direct, it immediately gets to the point. I like it. A Japanese person may be like, it's very rude, you know, it needs to have this whole apologetic preamble, you know, it doesn't use the right kind of, doesn't sound respectful enough, right? So if you have predominantly Western labelers or people who label Western data, then you're gonna teach the model to be very direct, you know, low context, kind of communication, transactional relationships, and that sort of thing. So that's another source for cultural bias in AI models. And they exhibit it big time, really. There's a lot of research, benchmarking, you know, evaluations of language models. Over and over again, they show that large language models from the big providers align with Western cultural values.
I mean, yeah. Is there such a thing as an unbiased AI model? We're all biased to some extent, everyone out there, right? Like biased based on our life experience, our parents, I guess. Like, how do we do this? Because so an AI model learns from what we give them, you know?
So is there anything like an unbiased model? Well, bias in a way is in the eye of the observer in one sense, right? While I can interpret something as being biased, you may say, no, that's totally fine. I think bias is very, very culture specific. But then again, there is objective bias, for example, gender, racial bias, right? Age bias. And a lot of that bias is also historic bias. So these are biases that AI creeped into AI models from historical training data, for example, literature from the 19th century. Unfortunately, it is enough to have very few examples of bias for a model to learn that bias. This is also has been explored a lot in data poisoning, you know, and trying to misalign models. A recent research came out which shows that 250 poisoned examples are enough to actually make a model learn a behavior or learn something that is undesired, an undesired feature. So it's enough to have 250 data chunks that exhibit a particular type of bias for the AI model to actually absorb it. It's a shocking finding. And what is even more shocking is that it doesn't depend on the size of the model. It's not a percentage. It's an absolute number. So whether your model will be 6B parameters or 13B parameters, it's about 250. Imagine how easy it is to skew the behavior of a large language model.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Very interesting. Thank you. My next question is a bit more language related from, you know, my translator past, I guess. It seems like it's so easy for a model to learn language patterns and, you know, understand that, but then it struggles with the culture and the context part of things. Why is that?
Let me maybe start with the learning. What does a language model learn when it sees language? Well, it basically learns statistical patterns. So this is a very, very fancy autocomplete. State-of-the-art models are more than that because they're also trained on reasoning. They're trained on code. They are trained to access, they can access tools, right? But they still work based on pure statistics. And you can extract statistical patterns from linguistic data, identify relationships, but it stays at the level of the linguistic data. In order to absorb culture, you need to go one level deeper and actually go beyond language. Language, it's like a tip of an iceberg. Language is 10% of culture. The rest is shared history, religion, interpersonal relationships, traditions, and that is not encoded in language in such a way that it's statistical, right? It is, you can see at the culture through the lens of language. And to a certain extent, the two are correlated, right? You've probably studied about the famous Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which says that language influences the way people see the world. You know, if you have 1,000, like 100 words of snow, you know, it's gonna, you know, make you perceive snow in a different way than if you have words for something else. So language does influence thinking to a certain extent. I think it's also the other way around. Like if you live in a place with snow, you're gonna have 100 words about snow. And if you don't have snow, then why do you need the words in the first place, right? And one would be enough, like something white and cold, yeah? But when AI learns language, it basically extracts the statistical patterns. It learns code as well. AI is excellent at learning code. Does it understand the goal of programming when it programs an app, right? Writes the code, which is a type of very well-regulated language. Like, does it actually intend to create the thing it creates? No. It's the same with language. So it produces language, but does it understand the intent? I think the best way to put it is like, with humans, when we communicate, when we read between the lines. Actually, communication is a lot about the things you don't say than the things you actually say. AI reads the lines. We read between them. And it's between the lines where culture hides.
And how big is this problem when AI is deployed globally?
The problem is big and growing. And the problem has as a root the fact that most of the models that are being used globally are Silicon Valley models, right? There are some Chinese models, but to a certain extent, they're trained on the same data or they distill mutually outputs. So it's Silicon Valley culture. When these models are deployed globally, then in markets where regions where the culture is very different, they still produce this American-centric or Western-centric type of output with the values shining through, right? The cultural values, the communication style, and so on. So you have probably experienced that whenever you ask one of the big models a question, often they come back with, this is such an excellent question, genius, brilliant, you know, especially some models are really very exaggerating, yeah. Right? And in my culture, this feels like, what did I do wrong? What's happening here? Like, I just ask a simple question and I don't need to be convinced I'm a genius and it's amazing, even if the question is really silly, right? So for my culture, this sounds annoying. This is like, you are not really honest with me here. You're trying to please me. But I guess in other cultures, this is just taken as granted and you ignore it. Like, you don't really take it seriously, asking yourself, am I really a genius? Yeah, I never thought so. Now, on a more serious note, this is also dangerous because this leads us to this algorithmic monoculture and cultural flattening. I just opened an article, like just before our podcast, as I was taking a break, I opened an article which was all about language flattening. So it's not even only culture, even language gets flattened. And we are using the same linguistic patterns that come from English, even when writing in different languages, right? So, if that happens in language, just think about what happens with culture, okay? So this also leads to digital imperialism in a way, right? You have this Western-centered culture being in a way imposed through AI models in Africa, in India, in China, right? It is definitely not a good development if you want to preserve diversity and the cultural richness. But there is an even bigger problem, and that is trust, as I mentioned. Culture, shared culture, is the most important factor for building trust, right? So if an AI model starts telling you how fantastic your silly question was, are you actually really going to trust what its response, right? It's not that you need to trust AI models blindly. I always say fact check, they hallucinate, right? But imagine that you are communicating, you're an end customer and you're communicating with an AI-powered chatbot for user like assistance. Say you have an online retail, you want to return your package or something happened, or you want to know where it's stuck, right? And then you start communicating with an AI chatbot, which just doesn't use the right tone and doesn't approach your issue from the right angle. It can be too direct or it can be overly polite. I had a problem recently. I was communicating with a Chinese-based chatbot, which was so polite that I was at some point wondering, is this thing ever going to resolve my problem, or is it just going to profusely apologize forever? Right? In the end, I got it resolved. It was actually a very well done AI-powered chatbot. I really enjoyed communicating with it, trying to see how it's made, right? I mean, I started trying to dismantle it and say, like, does it use tools? Yeah. Will it make an agentic call there and there? Like, in the end, yeah, it hallucinated twice on numbers. But then it got it right. So back to the topic of culture. It is a very big problem. And the more enterprises adopt AI, the more they risk to flatten the way they talk to different markets, homogenize culture. And I think it's going to be a problem in general for humanity.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you say it, I can see that happen. Like you... It's just going to be standardized, everything, in a way. It's a bit scary.
Yeah. Well, in a way, it is a natural development of this whole globalization trend, right? I mean, when you think about it, when I was a kid and I would go to a foreign country on a holiday, I was so excited because you go to a shop and it's completely different stuff, right? And you've never seen that even. Nowadays, I go to a shop in any European country, and it's all the same on the supermarket shelves, right? I mean, you have these little things like you are going to get fiskekaker in Norway, right? I mean, I don't know the word in English. Fish cakes. Yeah, I don't think you can buy fish cakes in Spain.
Pretty sure we can.
Yes. So there are a few things that have remained local, but apart from that, it's all very, very standardized. So it becomes boring to travel in a way. Well, similarly, culture gets standardized.
Mm, yeah. How should leaders ensure that AI remains culturally competent, trustworthy, and accountable at scale as well?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I've been thinking about that, and I think I have a recipe with the main ingredients, right? Step-by-step manual, instruction manual. So let me break this down. So leaders, the first thing they need to do is actually establish the culture of their brand, like what we were talking about, right? Just do it. Like, what do you want the message to be? Like, who are you exactly, as you put it? What are your values? How do you, market your products? What do you want people to take from that? Like the main message, the main emotion as well. Right. And then this is non-negotiable. This shouldn't change. Right. As we said, just do it shouldn't be like, let's all do it together. Right. This is your message. So define the core and then start fine-tuning the recipe, you know, the way the core feels and sounds for different regions and markets. For that, what you need to do is actually benchmark, identify what are the cultural values of every region. I believe not all enterprises have mapped out the cultures of the markets. So they probably have a lot of data about, you know, sales, conversion rates, whatever. But do you actually, as a leader, have a cultural map of your markets? Do you know whether this market is a collectivist type of culture, which value cohesion and being together, respect for the elderly, and, for example, have kind of a, let's say, non-linear idea of time. And that market might be valuing efficiency and directness, and they are very low context, and they have this linear plan time, you know, and they need to be talked to in a very direct, very short and condensed type of way. So after you've defined your core culture and the values, then go out onto the markets and map them culturally. For that, you need cultural specialists. You need people who will tell you on these dimensions, and there are various ways, like there are various studies, you know, of cultural dimensions. You have the famous Hofstede cultural dimensions, 6 different dimensions, right? You have some frameworks with 12 different dimensions. So choose your favorite framework and define, you know, where each market sits. Next thing that needs to be done is start testing, right? Create prompts, because this is for AI implementation, right? Create prompts that will tweak the message, the core message, so that it talks to the people in the different regions, to their culture, right? So create different types of messages, play with prompts, create basically a test set, like a rich test set for modifying the core messages so that it speaks to the end users in each market, and then evaluate. Okay, again, evaluate using local experts, cultural specialists, you know, people who understand. Gather the feedback and incorporate again into your prompt, your solution, your workflow, whatever you have there, right? So so that you actually gather the learnings, test again until you've gotten it right. Now, I bet your next question will be like, how do you implement that? How do you tweak an AI model, you know, to talk to Japanese audience in one way and to a German audience in another way? Well, there are, again, different solutions, and each one of them has a different level of invasiveness. I call it invasiveness. First one, you can try to do it through prompting, right? You can try to start your prompt with this famous role prompting, like you're a Japanese, I don't know, customer support agent, and you are very polite. You always apologize, you know, to your to the user, and so like give the guidelines for the model. If that doesn't work, because sometimes this role prompting actually doesn't work that well, you can go one level more invasive and use something that is called soft prompting. For that, you already need like more technical expertise. This is soft prompting is a very interesting. It's not very much talked about. Like soft prompting is a bit similar to fine-tuning a model, but you actually don't really change its weights. You know, when you fine-tune a model, you go under the hood and you basically change the value of these little parameters, you know, you tweak the numbers inside, because it's the numbers that encode knowledge. Knowledge is stored in the numbers. And if you want to change the knowledge and the behavior of a model, you change those numbers through fine-tuning, but then you risk that the model is going to forget what it knew before, right? Because you've changed the numbers. Cultural soft prompting is you kind of append a special type of a vector in front of the prompt, which in a way sways the behavior of a model to a particular like way of, say, talking. So you can kind of prepend this, like there is a preamble, a vector preamble, which can make the model be more polite or more direct, more verbose or like really concise or flattering or non-flattering. And yeah, if that doesn't work, fine-tuning, partial fine-tuning, not full fine-tuning. Full fine-tuning is very risky. Partial fine-tuning may be the solution. If that doesn't work, human in the loop. I actually think you always need to have human in the loop, but human in the loop is not very scalable. Right, human in the loop is not very scalable. So there are different levels, yeah. The best thing would be, of course, train your own model, but this is hardly feasible, yeah. This is too time-consuming, you probably wouldn't have the capabilities and the resources to train a large language model. It's going to be a small language model. And after all, the capabilities of models are directly correlated to their size. So the bigger the model, the more capable. So that is a little bit of a trade-off there. Yeah. And once this is done, like depends on which method you have used to actually get the model to produce the culturally fine-tuned and appropriate type of text or interaction or images. Can be anything. This applies to any modality, right? Then monitor all the time. Monitor all the time, right? You need to have constant sampling, monitoring to make sure that the model still behaves, produces the right output. Cultures change, you know, model behavior may change for some reason. So especially if you are not working with your own model, but you are using a model by a third-party provider, then you have to monitor all the time.
Monitor. Okay. We have the little secret recipe here.
Yes. Try that recipe. Yeah. Tell me what you've cooked.
Can I ask you, do you have something to add? Maybe something like an anecdote, something you would like to mention that, you know, we haven't covered before?
Anecdotes, many of AI models going wrong, right? But I actually want to add something more philosophical. I've been on a bit of a philosophical wave lately. I was thinking a lot about innovation. There was an innovation week last week organized by RWS. And this is what struck me one day. And I find that like a very interesting observation. I don't know, might not be very unique, but here it is. Any innovation that we have had so far in human history has been fully explainable by the creator of the innovation. So people invented the wheel, they could explain how it works. James Watt invented the steam machine. He could explain every little detail, like why is it that if you put water there and you heat it, then steam comes out there and it works, right? Bell invented the telephone. He could explain the telephone in every detail. And that was a predictable machine. It's a deterministic technology. And that has been always true of technological innovations until the Transformers came out and AI in general. Now we are creating models, we are creating technology that we have no idea how it works. In fact, there is a whole branch of science emerging, which is AI neuroscience. The researchers, machine learning researchers, are peeking under the hood of AI models, basically using the same methods to investigate what is happening there. Which neurons get activated when I do this? How can I tweak the behavior? What will happen if I deactivate that neuron or activate that one? That's exactly what neuroscientists do with our human brains when they want to understand how it works. What will happen if we kind of send mild electricity impulse to that part of the brain? Oh, the hand goes up. Interesting. Yeah. So we are using the same technology to explore the electronic brain as we are exploring the human brain, which is one of the big mysteries, right? We still don't understand how that works. And it strikes me that we have created something that we ourselves then need to research to understand how it works. We are as if playing God here. We have creating something that is beyond us and we cannot explain it in the tiniest detail. And this is why we are having this whole cultural dimension conversations because now culture becomes relevant, right? When you have created an entity, a type of intelligence with which is not just a tool anymore. It's not deterministic. You cannot predict what it's going to do, like the way you can predict what a hammer is going to do or what a telephone is going to do or like how electricity flows through the wires, right? That's when you stop interacting with that technology as a tool, but you start interacting with this technology as a collaborator. AI is already a collaborator. It's not a tool. You know, people use it as a brainstorming partner, idea generation partner. Some people use it as a psychiatrist and even a friend, okay? This becomes a different type of intelligence which is now collaborating with us. And because of that, we need it also culturally attuned to us. Until now, you don't really care what the culture of your phone is because it's just irrelevant, right? That's not even a question. But you do want to have the culture. You want to have this new type of tool, a collaborative tool, to actually share your values, share your moral principles, share your ethical principles, because it's gone beyond the stage of being just a tool. So that's what I've been thinking about lately.
It's so interesting.
Yeah.
So interesting. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Maybe I have one last question. Very, very quick answer. What is cultural intelligence for you?
So for me, cultural intelligence, both in humans and AI, actually means being able to make yourself understood and communicate with any culture which is out there. Not have any stereotypes, preconceptions, be open and have the ability of communicating and understanding a human being or an end user or an AI model, whatever it may be, that has a different system of values, rules, behavioral patterns. That's what cultural intelligence is for me.
Okay, thank you. That was it. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you.
And stay tuned for the next episode.